You're listening to Opus Talks, where you'll be in on conversations with insiders in the energy, chemicals, and environmental commodities markets. Guests share insights into the latest trends and innovations, industry challenges, and much more. Let's dive into the conversations that explore where the energy economy is headed, right here on Opus Talks.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Opus Talks. We're very, very excited today. We have someone who's been in the carbon market for quite some time, and we're very, very excited to learn more about not only the evolution of carbon markets here in Europe over the past two decades, but also what's next. Here today, we have Mark Lewis. I will let Mark introduce himself. Mark, welcome.
Thanks, Umberto. Pleasure to be with you. So I have been covering the European carbon market and related markets, the old Kyoto markets and now the Paris market, since 2005. I think I was the first dedicated full-time carbon analyst in the City of London when I was working at Deutsche Bank back in the day there. So for the last 20 years, I've really been focused on the overlap between energy markets and environmental markets and the whole impact of climate change on European and global energy policy. I recently left my most recent employment at Andoran Capital, which is a dedicated commodities hedge fund, where I was first head of carbon research and climate research. And then after that, I was co-fund manager of an energy transition fund. And I'm taking the summer out to think about what comes next. There's lots of really exciting stuff going on in the carbon markets over the next 5 years, which we'll get into in the course of this discussion, I am sure.
Absolutely. And it's exciting to see the beginning of a new chapter, the closing of another one. Before we get into what the last two decades have been and your experience in markets, I'm just this past month and just looking at carbon markets now, especially the EU. I mean, we've seen EUA prices stuck between high 60 euros per metric ton, low 70 euros per metric ton for the past year. What will cause EUAs to break out from this trading range?
Well, I think what will cause it to break out, and I think the breakout is probably coming within the next 6 months, definitely within the next 12 to 18 months, I think a very dramatic breakout to the upside as a result of the successive years of deficit that we are about to enter into. I think 2026 onwards, the market starts moving into consecutive deficits between now and 2030. And that will mean that the outstanding inventory of EUAs in the market, what we in the carbon market technically refer to as the total number of allowances in circulation or the TNAC, but in any other commodity market, that would simply be referred to as the inventory. As that inventory starts to draw down each year with successive annual deficits, i.e. deficits of supply relative to demand, you should see prices structurally moving into a more bullish phase. And I think the second thing that will help with that, I mean, that's the primary thing. Inventory drops, price goes up. That's pretty much rule one on page one of any commodities trading handbook, right? And then on top of that, the realization that the market is going into a period of deficits will concentrate the mind on the longer term picture, which is, as the legislation is written at the moment, the EU ETS cap falls to zero by 2040. And you don't have natural sellers in this market. You only have natural buyers. What do I mean by that? I mean that in any other commodity market, you have producers and buyers, right? I mean, take the oil market, you have the large national oil companies, your Saudi Aramcos, your ADNOCs, et cetera, and then your private sector companies, your Exxons and your Chevrons and your Shells and so forth. They produce oil and they sell it to the natural buyers. So you have natural producers or natural sellers and natural buyers, natural consumers. In the EU carbon market, you don't have that. What you have is a regulator who creates a fixed supply of the commodity in question, here, European carbon allowances. And what we know two things. The supply is fixed, but it's declining every year to 2040. So you put those two pieces of information together, a fixed and rapidly declining supply of allowances, together with the fact that there are no natural sellers, only natural buyers. That doesn't mean to say from time to time there aren't going to be people selling, obviously. But what it does mean is the supply of the commodity is outside the control of the players in the market. There's nobody producing it. The European Commission, it's a political construct of a market, and therefore the allowances have been created by regulatory statute. And yes, those can ultimately be changed if there's really the need to do it, but it is incredibly complicated and difficult to do that. So that's how I always frame any discussion on the EU ETS for people looking at it relative to other commodity markets. It has these two unique features, a fixed and declining supply, declining to zero, and no natural sellers.
And Mark, I'm very interested in what you say about long-term, looking at this market long-term. There's a number of recent developments that we will get into, but I am curious about one specifically now is the introduction of the CBAM. We'll see the CBAM being gradually phased in from 2026 to 2034. But also, industry in the European Union will see its free allowance phased out and fully removed by 2034. I'm curious, when it comes to the removal, the phasing out of free allowances, how do you see the industrial sector preparing for this? They rely on free allowances, but in the long term, how will this affect market dynamics?
So this is an excellent point, and it's one I think that will have a very big impact on the market because it's all to do with behavioral psychology, right? I mean, just to remind your listeners, the ETS began in 2005, and since 2008, the power generation sector has had to buy 100% of its allowances in the market at the auctions that take place pretty much every day, every business day, aside from the two kind of holiday periods in the year. Whereas all the other sectors covered by the scheme, so the steel sector, the chemical sector, the oil and gas sector for refineries, cement, all of these other sectors have been receiving, right from 2005, all of their allowances for free. Now, with the introduction of CBAM, the carbon border adjustment mechanism, there will be a carbon price at the border. And that means that, because why do we have free allowances in the first place? We have free allowances because European companies would otherwise be penalized in having to pay a carbon price that their competitors from outside Europe, who are nonetheless selling into the European market, do not have to pay. So when you phase out free allowances, you have to ensure that the playing field is level for European companies. And the way you do that is you say, okay, any company from outside Europe selling into the European market in these sectors will have to pay the same carbon price as European players. Now, two further corollaries to that. One is that the phase out of free allowances will take place progressively over quite a long period of time, over 9 years. It's 2034 that we will see. It's only in 2034 that we will see 100% of allowances being bought by industrials. It gives them some time to adjust. But remember, it's not just the phase out of free allowances, it's the reduction in the cap overall. So they're being squeezed from two sides. The total number of allowances available in the market is declining. The pie is shrinking. And the share of the pie that they get for free is also shrinking. Now, this is a very new state of affairs for the industrial sector. They're going to have to completely change the way they think about hedging carbon risk into the future. And that's why I made the point about behavioral psychology. I think once 2, 3, 4 of the big industrials decide that they need to go into the market and hedge forward to, let's say, 2030, 2032, and I think that day is coming where one of these big companies will do that, it will change the entire dynamic of the market, because I think it will make other industrials sit up and take notice and say, wait a minute, if they're doing it, we need to do it. Otherwise, we're going to be left chasing and playing catch up when prices are going up. The other thing I wanted to say is that although it's a level playing field on one side of the ledger, European companies are nonetheless being penalized as exporters, because you do not, if you lose your free allowances and you're exporting into foreign markets where there is no carbon price, then obviously you're being penalized there. So that remains a sticking point, I think, in the whole debate around CBAM and free allowances that has never been satisfactorily resolved. And I think that is an issue that could come back to cause political problems for the market. Because, you know, there's one extra piece that flows from all of this. Everything I've said so far sounds very bullish, right? So if you have a market where the setup looks bullish, it will attract further speculative capital into the market. So I would argue you are likely to see more hedge funds, more even of the kind of conservative institutional money coming into this market over the next 18 months, 2 years, because they see the setup is fundamentally bullish and they want to benefit from that. And so I think there is a strong possibility, and depending on your perspective, it could be perceived as a strong risk if you're an industrial company, that this nexus of factors will push prices up quite suddenly and quite violently between now and, let's say, the end of 2027, over the next 18, 24 months. And it will cause a kind of vicious circle where industrials are having to buy more to hedge, and then that only increases the appetite of hedge funds. So I think the one blot on the landscape that I can see here is the political risk that regulators might start worrying about the impact all of this is having on industrial competitiveness in Europe, particularly in light of the recent EU-US trade deal, where Europe is already going to have to cope with 15% tariffs on a number of exported goods to the United States. This is all very tricky. And for a European economy that's been dealing with very high, by historical standards, energy prices more generally, by which I mean power prices, gas prices, if carbon goes into this structural bull phase, as I expect, then that will be a further element to worry about for in terms of competitiveness. So that's where I think the risk is on prices. But overall, putting together everything we've just talked about, I think the setup looks very bullish.
Very, very interesting. And it's interesting. I mean, even I believe a year ago at a conference in Florence, you mentioned that we were in a no man's land. And now we're seeing the potential increasing role of speculative investors, CBAM, free allowances being phased out. There's also a number of, in the years since then, we've seen a number of developments, like the announcement of linkage between markets. The UK itself is looking at the integration of greenhouse gas removals, the inclusion of shipping. There's a lot of things to keep track of. But Mark, I'm wondering, you as someone who's been in this market for two decades, what developments are you most looking at as potential bullish or bearish? Which factors are you most excited or interested about?
Well, I think the first factor I mentioned, really, the fact that the inventory is declining, because that in any commodities market, that is always a signal of bullishness. The level of inventory, the level of market inventory is still very significant, right? So if you think about the oil market, normally what you see in the oil market is 3 months worth of consumption held in storage or inventory, okay? And in the European Union at the moment, we have probably 1 year's worth of inventory held in the form of TNAC, because the TNAC at the moment is around just over a billion tons, and the annual emissions are just over a billion tons. So that's still a very substantial amount. But over the next 2-3 years, as that is drawn down, I mean, I think we're looking at triple digit mismatches between supply and demand. And, you know, that means that the TNAC could fall very significantly over the next 3 years. And then it will stabilize a bit more, because the market stability reserve will no longer be taking allowances out of the market, because you go through that threshold where the market stability reserve is no longer needed under the terms of the legislation. But the next 3 years are going to be characterized by falling inventory, and therefore, I think, higher prices. As I'd say, that's the most significant thing. But I do think the impact on behavioral psychology of the introduction of CBAM and the phasing out of free allowances is also a very significant moment, because, I mean, it's impossible to know exactly how industrials will prepare for this. I noticed that we've seen a couple of reports coming out recently, most recently by Eurofer, the trade association for the European steel industry, saying that Brussels should be very careful about how they implement the changes to the EU ETS over the next, the changes that are already in law, as it were, you know, the reduction of the cap, the phasing in of CBAM, the phase out of free allowances. There is undoubtedly a lot of concern in some of these industries, and steel, the steel industry has put together a report. I think it was only published end of July. So there is going to be a lot of lobbying. There is going to be a lot of intense political debate around this. And of course, it doesn't help that we now have the ultra-conservative populist bloc in the European Parliament in charge of this dossier, in charge of the EU ETS. And I notice that you have some parliamentarians, members of that bloc, who are saying we need to rethink, and that the 90% reduction target to 2040, which is an EU-wide target, but the reduction in the EU ETS cap to zero by 2040 is an integral part of that 90% EU-wide target. So I think you're going to see more political headwinds around all of this. And as I said a few moments ago, the trade situation with the United States, the tariffs, that doesn't help anybody. But the reality is this is written into law, and it's very difficult to change the law. My own view is that where this debate goes next is around, and I noticed that the Eurofair report that I just referenced made a comment about this, is that the greater use of international credits should be allowed, particularly in my view, beyond 2030. I don't think there's any prospect of that happening before 2030. But after 2030, you really are going to need some kind of safety valve for prices, because otherwise, if you leave the legislation as it is at the moment, then effectively the cap falls to zero by 2040, which means over the period 2031 to 2040, the final trading phase of the EU ETS, the average cap over that 10-year period will be around 400 million tons. In other words, we're starting in 2031 with a cap of about 800, something like that, and it falls to zero by 2040. So your average over the period is 400 million. And at the beginning of the period, we're still going to be running at kind of 800 million. Cutting your emissions by that amount in these other industries, I mean, the power sector is different. The power sector is decarbonizing rapidly with greater use of solar and wind and batteries and so on. But industry hasn't got that yet. So whether it be in the form of CCS, whether it be in the form of green hydrogen, there are technological solutions that can be, that can help to reduce industrial emissions. But I'm convinced that we will have to see an allowed quota of international credits. And the most obvious form of credits that they should allow in are the so-called Article 6 credits under the Paris Agreement with corresponding adjustments, because that way all of the emissions credits that you allow in from outside Europe are accounted for under the Paris Agreement. There's no risk of double counting. There's no risk, therefore, of undermining the environmental integrity of the scheme. So I think that works very nicely. And that's the beauty of the architecture of the Paris Agreement. It allows for this matching of emissions reductions around the world with no double counting. So I think personally that will come. And there'll be a lot of debate about, you know, what should the size of that overall quota be? And should there be any geographical limitations on it? But I think that's coming. I think otherwise we're talking about probably an existential crisis for European industry over the next decade if there isn't some kind of safety valve in terms of prices there. But for the time being, the European Commission is not willing to move on this. You know, we only just had them at the beginning of July. They published the target for EU-wide reduction. I mentioned just a few moments ago, 90% reduction versus 1990 by 2040. And they said, well, we'll make this a bit more flexible. We will allow some international offsets to count towards that 90% reduction target, but not in the EU ETS. So only in sectors of the economy that are not covered by the EU ETS, or at least ETS-1, as we kind of increasingly call it nowadays to distinguish it from ETS2, which is the new market that starts next year, covering the heat and transportation sectors. But even there, you know, just to put the numbers into context, what they said is 3% form of international offsets per year over 2036 to 2040. So a 5-year period, which is still 10 years away, it comes to 150 million tons in total. That's 30 million tons per year. That's 1 million tons per member state per year. over 5 years, not until 2036. It's completely delusional to think that that volume of credits outside ETS1 and only in ETS2 and the residual sectors of the economy that are not covered by ETS2 either will be sufficient to enable European industry to maintain its competitiveness as the cap declines to zero by 2040. So I think that is inevitably going to come back onto the agenda sooner rather than later. It makes total sense to me that the steel industry in Europe is arguing for that. Why wouldn't they? They had experience of the CDM and the JI in the old days under this. Actually is progress upon CDM and JI because Article 6 credits, for the reasons I just referenced, are part of the Paris architecture and they avoid this concern over double counting. So I think for all those reasons, this will come back onto the agenda sooner rather than later, but not before 2030. So I think until 2030, you've got this very bullish outlook. And then beyond 2030, there's going to have to be some movement on that point about allowing international offsets into the EU ETS.
Very, very interesting, especially as we know that that plan and about the inclusion of international carbon credits gained had a lot of pushback. I'm wondering, do you think that percentage, it sounds like that percentage should go up, but two, another way, say, pivoting to the UK ETS, the UK ETS is doing something similar, but only domestically. They published a consultation response earlier this month showing that they would be integrating greenhouse gas removals engineered, meaning the direct air capture, CCUS, and domestically only. This is, I believe, the first time, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, I think this is the first time a emissions trading scheme is very open to integrating these types of removals. And I believe from what I read in the consultation, it seems that there would be no limit as to the proportion of greenhouse gas removal allowances that you could include. What do you make of this integration and this commitment to push it?
Well, I think it makes total sense is the first thing to say. The UK was a full member of the EU ETS until 2020. The UK was actually instrumental in the early days of pushing the European Union towards establishing a carbon trading market rather than a carbon tax. So I think philosophically, they are aligned in terms of how you put a price on carbon in the economy. And I think clearly with the political changes we've had in the UK with a new government over the last year now trying to be more constructive in terms of European engagement, which the last Conservative government very definitely was not because, you know, they were the ones, the architects of the Brexit policy. So I think the situation now is that we will probably have a link in place, a formal link in place between the UK ETS and the EU ETS, I would say by at the latest 2028. But in reality, the prices have already converged a lot compared with where they were at the beginning of the year, right? Because we had a huge discount at which UKAs were trading relative to EUAs in January. It was 40 euros a ton of discount. And now we're more back to sort of a range of between 5 and 10 euros a ton. And I think it will probably remain in that range until we see confirmation that the link is going ahead. And that'll just be, you know, one of those discounts that exists that will be arbitrage every time it falls to a narrow discount. It will be sold off again. And every time it widens to a big discount, it will be bought again. And that's how it will play out. But I think it makes total sense. Again, though, I would say there's political issues in the UK. This government, although it has a very big majority, has lost a lot of support over the last year. If there were an election tomorrow, it's almost, at least if you base yourself on the opinion polls, it would be the Reform Party that would win. And the Reform Party is dead against carbon pricing in general and linking UK carbon prices to the EU in particular. Now, this government, in the ordinary course of affairs, has another 4 years in office with a very big majority. So they can do, within reason, they can do pretty much whatever they want. And I think they do want to get this done. It would be harder, you know, say they've got this done late 27, early 28, and then the UK general election is in 2029. And even if the opinion polls haven't changed and it's Reform that comes in and wins in 2029, it's not an easy thing to rip up something like that because people forget. But what you do is you create vested interests, and industry wants this. Industry wants linking with the EU ETS. UK industry wants that because it gives them better visibility on the carbon price in their own, and it means you're not going to be subject to the CBAM in Europe. So I think there's a lot of saber rattling going on, a lot of noise. I'm paying close attention to it, but I'm not yet, at least, losing any sleep over it. I think, you know, the base case is this happens. It happens by 2028 at the latest, probably earlier than that. And all things considered, I would say it will happen in a way that means the two markets are linked all the way through now until the end in 2040.
And Mark, talking about CBAM and linkage, I mean, we've seen linkage before, I believe, currently between the EU and the Swiss market. I mean, you started on this market in the mid-2000s. I mean, now we're seeing emerging carbon markets in Turkey, in Brazil, in Japan, and they all have their unique features. I'm wondering, are there some markets that you're looking into with interest? And what advice would you give to government or legislators implementing these markets? What would be your advice as something to look out for in the early days of these markets?
Yeah, I mean, so I think that's a very interesting question. I think what we have is already some compliance markets that don't get as much attention as the EU ETS. So California, for example, that's now a very well-established market that's been very disappointing in terms of price action for investors, at least, over the last 2 years. There's been a lot of political problems there. But those probably look as if they will be resolved now, if not by the end of this year, then kind of Q1 at the latest next year. And the fundamental drivers of that, once we get through all the political noise, look very bullish. So I think California is one to keep your eye on if you are looking at this on a 6 to 12 month view. No rush, no urgency to get involved with it yet, but that market is going to come back, I think. And then, as you rightly said, Umberto, you've got other jurisdictions that are putting in place markets, Turkey, the really big one, and you've got a couple going on in Latin America, nothing big at this stage, but there's some stuff going on out there. But the really big one, obviously, is China. And I think China, for the time being, it's currently only covering the power generation sector. That will be expanded progressively. It's a very difficult market at the moment for foreign investors to get exposure to. The thing about China is, what we know about China is, when they do something, they do it with total commitment. I mean, if you look at how they have rolled out renewable energy over the last 15 years, it's absolutely staggering the pace at which they have done that. And, you know, high-speed rail and all these things that they're doing to power the energy transition, both in part to meet their climate change commitments and in part for energy security reasons. These are incredible actions. And I think that carbon market, once it's fully up and running and operational, will be an extremely interesting one to look at for people from outside China. So that's something I'm keeping an eye on. Again, it's nothing urgent there, but I would think on a 2 to 3 year view, that will be shaping up very nicely as probably the biggest carbon market in the world, certainly by the end of the decade.
Very, very interesting. And yes, looking forward to see how that market develops, especially given its industrial heavyweight power. I'm curious, you talk about markets in the US. There is no federal or national level carbon market. The word tariff has been thrown around a lot by the US president. There's obviously the carbon border adjustment mechanism in Europe, which is a tariff on carbon. Do you see potential appetite for a US CBAM?
Well, I mean, I think it has been raised, you know, it has been mentioned from time to time. You know, my personal take on this is, any so-called CBAM that the United States might introduce, particularly under the Trump administration, would not be primarily driven by concerns about carbon dioxide emissions, right? It would just be a different kind of tariff. So I think that is not something that will play a big role, I don't think. I may be wrong, but it's not kind of how I read it at the moment. And in any case, if you look how much back and forth there has been on these Trump tariff announcements over the last 6 months, ever since he came into office, I mean, you don't know whether the tariff measures he announced are going to last, you know, 3 weeks. never mind 3 years. We've all become inured to these kinds of incendiary statements about tariffs. They are happening and they are real, and you know, but I don't think we are likely to see significant CBAM measures taken by the United States.
Interesting. Yeah, I think it has been raised before. I'm surprised it hasn't gained more traction. But like you said, the environmental concern is not a top priority for the current administration. Mark, it's been a really interesting chat, and I'm curious. I mean, you most recently left Enduran. You're taking some time to yourself. Well, what are your next steps after having been? I mean, you are a veteran of the market. What are your next steps?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think I wanted to refocus 100% of my time on carbon, and I had other responsibilities at Andoran that made that difficult. And I wanted to focus 100% on carbon because, as I've been explaining throughout the course of this conversation, over the next 5 years, I think we're in for probably the defining moment in European and, to a certain extent, global carbon markets. And I very much want to focus my time and expertise on those developments. Exactly how that plays out, we'll have to wait and see. I just got back literally from last week in Mexico, visiting a very interesting mangrove restoration project in the state of Veracruz. Incredibly interesting work going on there. Potential, we'll wait and see. Potential perhaps for Article 6 crediting of projects like that, which I think would be very much a step in the right direction. So I'm kind of still figuring out exactly what the next step is, and I want to do some more writing. You know, I very much enjoy writing. I've just written up that Mexican piece as a literary travelogue, as it were, looking at, I've written a piece called Macbeth Amongst the Mangroves, looking at how some of Shakespeare's most famous works can be read as allegories for climate change and restoration through nature. And I'll have a better idea of where things are going in the next couple of months. But for the time being, I'm just enjoying the summer and keeping an eye on carbon markets and another eye on my Shakespeare projects.
Very, very exciting, Mark. Mark, it's always a delight to talk. Thank you for joining us in this conversation. We've talked on so many different topics, but it's very, very excited for what's ahead. And thank you again for being with us.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks very much for having me on.
We hope you've enjoyed today's insider conversation on Opus Talks. Join us next time for a deep dive into another industry insider's world. You can find more Opus Talks episodes at opusnet.com/podcasts or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.